From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The body count is now at 34 from the twin bombings that rocked the Russian city of Volgograd earlier this week. We have this on-the-ground report from RT.
It is tense. It's also very somber. Traffic seems to be moving more slowly. I was able to catch up with some of the family members of people who have died, namely the father of the security guard, who's one of two people who will be having a funeral today. And here is their story.
It's been one more an uneasy night for the residents of Russia's southern city of Volgograd. Loved ones of the injured in two terror attacks held vigils in hospitals. Others mourned.
He was a good man, a good father, a good son, a good grandson. There are not so many of such good ones around. The good ones die first, they say.
With barely contained tears, Vladimir Nelivenko clutches the memory of his son, who was the first victim of Sunday's attack in the train station. Sergei was a security guard there.
He had this job for about a year. I saw how it all happened on the video footage. He was standing by the railing during the security check, and then there was this man coming in, and he just barely made it towards him, and then there was a blast, and it was over, and no more footage. He stopped that man who was trying to get through the security gate, as he had to. Yes, that's what the camera showed. I saw him doing his job, smiling. He did what he had to do. That was his duty.
Sergei's family mourned Monday night with only the conviction that he carried out his responsibilities to bring them any small comfort. For others in Volgograd, the night brought fragile relief and the knowledge their loved ones were spared. But they woke up the next morning to a second suicide bomber, this time on a city trolley bus.
I can't remember anything. I was deafened by the blast. We had almost reached the bus stop when the explosion went off. It was like an electric shock all over my body. I can't remember. I didn't see anyone. I was sitting and looking out of the window when it happened. I think I was the last to be carried out of the trolley bus.
Now, no doubt, any of the people of the southern Russian city expected to have two suicide bombers factored into their New Year's Eve celebration, shopping, and travel plans. Volgograd is still reeling after two terror attacks within the span of 24 hours. We met Vitaly in his home just hours after his friend was killed.
I was shocked. He had a family, a young wife, and a small child. It's very sad to realize that a young man died in such a tragic incident.
Stories like these are pouring over the Volgograd city limits, with the residents there hoping for more time to mourn their families and friends and rebuild their lives. In Volgograd, Margaret Howell.
Iran says it has reached a deal with the P5+1 nations in Geneva that could begin a rollback of sanctions in late January. We have this report from Press TV's Kovi Tavwe from Tehran.
The head of Iran's negotiating team in expert level talks with the P5+1 says the two sides will start implementing the Geneva deal in late January. According to Hamid Baidi Nejad, both sides now share the same view on how to implement the Geneva deal. Earlier, Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany ended a new round of expert-level talks in Geneva. Iran's deputy foreign minister said good progress was made during the talks, which focused on a mechanism to implement last month's nuclear deal. Under the deal, the P5+1 group agreed to lift some of the existing sanctions against Iran in return for some limitations on Tehran's nuclear energy program. The deal will pave the way for a comprehensive agreement in 6 months.
Turkey's government said Tuesday it was fending off a, quote, attempted mini-coup, closed quote, by elements in the police and judiciary. The ruling AK party had in the past survived military plots, according to Deputy Prime Minister Ali Babacan, who added that the party would not now yield to a current corruption investigation that he said targeted the government and was damaging the national economy. Babacan said, quote, these latest formations in the judiciary and the police, we can't call it a coup, but a mini-coup attempt, close quote. The Turkish prime minister earlier accused the service movement led by Turkish cleric Fethullah Gulen of creating a, quote, state within a state, close quote. And in breaking news, a Turkish lawmaker from the ruling Justice and Development Party has resigned over the government's response to a high-profile corruption probe that has shaken the country's political establishment, Kovi Tavway reports.
Turkish lawmaker from the ruling party resigns over the government's response to a high-profile corruption probe. Justice and Development Party MP Hasan Hami İldirim has criticized the government of Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan for exerting pressure on the investigation. The probe has targeted people close to Erdogan, including the sons of three ministers. In response, the government has fired dozens of senior police officers involved in the probe. Several ministers and ruling party MPs have so far quit over the investigation. The scandal is posing a major challenge to Erdogan after 11 years in power.
Meanwhile, as we've previously reported, Turkey may be facing a resolution from the UN Security Council proposed by Syria over Turkish support for terrorism in Damascus and elsewhere in the country. We have this report from Press TV.
Damascus has officially asked the UN Security Council to prosecute Turkey and all countries that support the militants operating in Syria. In a letter addressed to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, Syria said that supporting insurgents is a violation of a UN Security Council resolution. Syria's ambassador to the UN, Bashar Ja'fari, said the Turkish authorities are systematically providing support to the insurgents by arming them and providing weapons to them. He added that the insurgents are carrying out terrorist attacks against the Syrian people, including religious minorities and even children, as well as against diplomatic missions. The Syria crisis began in 2011. According to the UN, over 100,000 people have been killed and millions displaced in the conflict. Joining us now is Mark Weber. He is the director of the Institute for Historical Review from Skype, via Skype, that is, from California. Dr. Weber, thank you very much for joining us here on Press TV. Now, this has been a long time coming. Many had hoped that Damascus would take Turkey to the UN Security Council to officially answer for its role in the crisis in Syria. How do you see this moving on forward?
Well, this new call by the Syrian government for UN Security Council to take action against Turkey and other countries for their support of the militant opposition in Syria is certainly understandable and justified. After all, if Turkey were dealing with a similar situation, it would issue a similar protest. If a neighboring country were to send weapons to militant Kurdish rebels in Turkey that oppose the Turkish government, for example. So it's an understandable and justified protest by Syria. Unfortunately, it's very unlikely that the Security Council will respond positively to this new call. For one thing, the U.S. government will certainly veto any such measure, given that the Obama administration itself has been supplying weapons and other aid to the insurgent forces in Syria.
Indeed, now, as you just mentioned, there are many who point out that this is more of a symbolic move on Damascus's part, in the sense that it will bring to light Turkey's role in a more international arena. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. Syria's call for UN action at least reminds the world, though, once again, of the hypocrisy of leaders who claim to respect the sovereignty of other countries, but who also, at the same time, support, as Turkey does and as the United States does, violent intervention in the internal affairs of Syria and other countries.
And can such an issue be raised at the Geneva II conference? Do you think Turkey might be held to account over there?
It's very unlikely. Turkey's position, of course, is a strong one, and in this matter, it's backed by the United States. So as you point out, or as other observers have pointed out, Syria's call is really largely symbolic. And so Syria doesn't have very much elbow room to actually make anything really happen at this point. Its main object right now, of course, is simply to resist and then to bring down or bring under control the militant opposition in Syria. That's really where this is all going to be decided, I think.
According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights today, more than 130,000 people have been killed in Syria since the conflict began in March of 2011, including 46,000 civilians and more than 7,000 children. A Bangladesh court today issued arrest warrants for two owners of a garment factory and four of their employees on homicide charges in the deaths of 112 workers killed in a fire that engulfed the factory last year. According to the Associated Press, Judge Wasim Sheikh issued the arrest warrants for the six, including owners Delwar Hossein and his wife Mahmouda Akhtar. All have reportedly fled, however. If they are not found by February 25th, when the court begins hearing their cases, they could be tried in absentia. It is reportedly the first time Bangladeshi authorities have prosecuted factory owners in the garment industry. Thailand's embattled Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra called for reconciliation today as the streets of Bangkok emptied ahead of New Year's celebrations, an abrupt period of calm after weeks of unrest. Anti-government protesters have vowed to disrupt the February 2nd election called by Yingluck in a bid to settle the crisis that has pitted her government against Bangkok's conservative elite and middle class. Demonstrators have threatened to shut down Bangkok after the new year passes, with plans to block roads in up to 20 places, although the scale of the protests has not always kept pace with the promises made by organizers. Yingluck has reportedly not been in Bangkok for more than a week. She's said to be spending time among supporters in the north and used social media to send a message seeking peace and reconciliation. One of the year's big stories was the passing of South African leader Nelson Mandela, but largely overlooked by the Western media was the current conditions that face post-apartheid and now post-Mandela South Africa. Journalist Michael Welsh spoke with Margaret Kimberly, senior editor and columnist with Black Agenda Report, to take an honest look at the realities facing the majority of black South Africans in the post-apartheid era and the present-day fruits of the compromises made by Mandela upon his release from jail.
Many who are knowledgeable about black liberation struggles in South Africa and abroad have dissented from the mainstream media narratives heralding Mandela as an iconic figure. One of those is Margaret Kimberly. She joins us from New York City. You've written a few columns already on this subject with regard to Nelson Mandela. What are some of the things you find most off-putting about the way Mr. Mandela has been portrayed in the media and by prominent politicians like Barack Obama?
Well, you know, Mandela, like many people, is a person of contradiction. And that the fullness of those contradictions have not been examined in the corporate media. It is true that he is a pivotal figure in South African history. It is true that he is a key figure in ending apartheid. It's true that he fought for decades, starting back in the 50s as a young man. But it's also true that he was released from prison, that apartheid ended, because of the Cuban army. Fidel Castro sent his forces to Angola, where they engaged the South African army. And it became clear that the South African army, we'd always been told that, well, there's no one who can beat the South African army, so apartheid cannot be defeated militarily. But the Cubans proved that that was not true. So that's something that has to be mentioned. It also has to be said, and this there are, one can give him credit and also be a detractor. In the 1950s, the African National Congress, the ANC, wrote a freedom charter, which promised, among other things, that South Africa's resources, the gold and diamonds, would be nationalized, that every person would have free education, would have free health care, that there would be reparations and a return of land taken by the Europeans. But in exchange for being released, Mandela he and some of his other ANC comrades chose to give up some of those agenda items that they had lived and fought for so many years. And that is a fact. It is easily provable and documentable, and it's something that should be talked about when talking about Mandela. So when he became president, and some of his former comrades have admitted this and expressed regret that the new government agreed to take out an IMF loan, which came with strings attached, which meant there was going to be no nationalization, no return of land. So it was a Pyrrhic victory in some ways. And the end result now is that black people in South Africa, the vast majority of people, live still in desperate poverty, and materially their lives have not improved in the past 20 years. Last year, well, one of the focal points, one of the things that brought the plight of black people under apartheid to the rest of the world was the Sharpeville massacre in the early 60s and the Soweto uprising in the 70s, where we saw people, civilians, young women and children being shot down by the police. Last year, under black rule, we saw, during a miner's strike at the Marikana mine, we saw once again black people being shot and killed by police, except this time some of the police were black, and they worked for a black-led government. So all of those things have to be discussed in talking about Mandela. And this image of him is, you know, this, he was all about reconciliation and peace. He did make choices, political choices, but you have to also talk about how he led an armed struggle. Mm-hmm. And even as he was imprisoned, he still supported that armed struggle for many years. So there are a lot of different elements of in Mandela's story and in the history of South Africa, but I think most of it has been left out in this watered-down, dumbed-down version of history that the corporate media present.
Yes, I've in, here in Canada, and there have been anti-apartheid resistance, solidarity struggles here as well. But I've heard from people, including people who themselves are from South Africa, they've argued that the compromises that were made by Mandela were in the interests of preventing bloodshed, and that there was some, you know, that basically some forgiveness there for that, the steps that he took. Do you buy that at all?
Well, it's hard to say what his motivation was. If his, you know, I know the motive of the forgiving man, and you know, that's a narrative that's always promoted for black people, that black people have to forgive. Some of us buy into that too, unfortunately. So I don't know if his motivation was forgiveness. I think he and others felt that they could not keep up the struggle. There it was a large unknown, and when he was released from prison, it was not, unfortunately, many people, myself included, saw it as the end of the struggle, and it was really the beginning of a new stage of struggle, is how it should have been seen. And one of his former comrades, his name is Ronnie Caswell, who I had the pleasure of meeting a few months ago, he's written about the choices. He now says those were bad choices, and he admits that they were afraid. They did not know what was going to happen. They thought they had to make these compromises, and he said they should have had more confidence in themselves and in the determination of the people. So you can turn down an IMF loan. That means you'll suffer some sort of way. There may be no trade deal or no aid or something that will make the struggle harder. But in retrospect, I think there are many people who say that those steps should have been taken, or at least been examined and considered more fully than they were at the time.
I find that, I mean, you can tell me if you agree, but I'm seeing a bit of a parallel with the former president of Haiti, Aristide, in the sense that he himself had been promoting these very progressive measures, and he had effectively been curtailed to the point where he had to make concessions, maybe not unlike Nelson Mandela. Is this... Did you see a parallel there as well? Maybe a sort of a similar modus operandi?
Well, it's a cautionary tale of what can happen for people who stand up. Aristide eventually was removed from office. The United States removed him from the presidency. and took sides in Haiti's internal struggle. They just got rid of him. So that's something that can happen. You know, people have been killed, like Allende in Chile was killed, and Aristide was removed. So there are parallels about what happens when people from the weaker nations, weaker militarily, weaker economically, when they choose to stand up, and how do you assert rights, the right to self-determination that every nation ought to have. And it's important to study who succeeds and who doesn't, and why not. In Zimbabwe, just to the north of South Africa, Mugabe is reviled around the world for his policies of returning land to African people, which obviously meant taking land from white, long-standing white settler population. So Zimbabwe has been subjected to, you know, sanctions which have ruined their economy. Their currency is worthless. But he's stuck to his guns, and it's a reality. And people are better off. Those people who obviously who got the land are got some of the land back are much better off. And he was true to that part of his struggle. But he and but his country has paid a tremendous price. In punishment by the rest of the world. Iran is subjected to horrible sanctions because the United States and Israel don't want Iran to have even the potential of becoming a nuclear power. They want Iran to knuckle under. So Iran's economy has been ruined. They've gotten a brief respite, but you know, they've been deprived of food and medicine and airplane parts, and they have oil which they can't even sell. So this is an ongoing problem of, I mean, the world word is imperialism, which people don't use much anymore, but we ought to, and how the powerful nations tell the weak nations what to do. So Mandela would have been taking a chance. It would have been very risky to say, no, thank you, won't take your IMF loan. And the apartheid government did have nukes. If Mandela had said, no, we'll keep the nukes, and no, we're not going to take your loan, and yeah, we might nationalize our resources. So who knows what would have happened to him, and what the stakes were very high. But I think you know, he had these difficult choices to make, but that does not mean that we, 20 years later, should shrink from pointing out these facts.
Now, you mentioned the hardship that's still endured by the vast majority of blacks in South Africa, and I find myself wondering if you know, apartheid wasn't really eliminated; it just changed venues in some sense. Is that too harsh?
Well, no, it's not too harsh. I mean, they don't have a pass system anymore, and black people can go where they like, and they're no longer vast numbers of people in prison, and they don't have Bantu stands anymore, and I'm sure nobody misses that, and nobody regrets that those things disappeared. Many individuals have done better, and part of the deal making and compromising, some individuals got very rich, so there are some rich black people in South Africa. But the masses of people struggle without running water, without electricity, or can't pay school fees, who still toil in these mines. So it's not too harsh to say that the conditions, their material condition, has not changed. That is a fact. Mm-hmm. That is true.
Well, we're looking at, I find with all the memorial services that I've seen here in Canada and through the media, the image of Mandela that I seem to keep seeing is not the figure from the days of the Freedom Charter or the early, you know, the 60s and 70s, but this, after he left jail, this basically grandfatherly and frankly harmless looking figure, that that seems to be the dominant image of iconic image of Nelson Mandela. Do you read anything into that as to why we're seeing that figure and maybe not to the from the period that before what you said, the struggle essentially came to an end?
Well, we're seeing it because it's the acceptable figure. It's the safe image. Reconciliation and forgiveness, and he didn't kill white people, and he didn't nationalize anything, so he was okay. It was okay to let him out of jail. It was okay for him to be the president because he didn't harm the status quo. So that's why we see that image. And unfortunately, I've seen here in the United States too many black people who, are more willing to tell the truth about Mandela and about his support for armed struggle. But there's too often we want to be accepted. So that, for example, when people on the right, his detractors said, well, Nelson Mandela was a communist. Well, it's true, he was. Many of the, if not all of the ANC leaders were members of South Africa's Communist Party. That was true. But people strive for respectability rather than for true liberation, so people take umbrage when someone would point out that he was a communist. Now, that should lead to a conversation. Well, why were they members of the South African Communist Party? Well, what is a communist? What would it have meant in South Africa? The capitalist world all sided with apartheid, so of course people fighting against apartheid would be communists. Is there anything wrong with being a communist? So instead of being willing to have this full debate, people shut it down because they wanted the respectability. They want this man to be acceptable in the eyes of the wider world, meaning in the eyes of white people. So ironically, some black people would cling to this phony image as well. Mm-hmm. But there's a cautionary tale there too. You know, the heroes, the real heroes of the world are people who are not bought necessarily by the powerful, by the corporate media, by the foreign governments. If you look at the late president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, nobody in the United States or the European nations went to his funeral. The president didn't have any statement of condolence to the Venezuelan people. No delegation went to his funeral. But there were millions, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Venezuela honoring this man who, despite the attacks against him, despite the attempts to thwart what he did, he's, for the most part, stuck to his program of a revolution in Venezuela, a revolution of power from the elites to the masses, getting a share of Venezuela's oil wealth and improving their lot in life. So here we have a man who stuck to his guns, who did what he said he was going to do for the people, and the result of that is we are told he was dangerous, crazy, a terrorist, not to be trusted, bad for the United States. I could go on and on and on. But he's the one who did the right thing by his people. So I think also there has to be an acknowledgement that when being praised by the wrong people is, should bring up skepticism. If the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the UK and the Prince and the Pope and this one and that one say someone was wonderful and a great leader and a wonderful man, you have to look askance at that person.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening, and have a happy new year.